ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Sibling rivalry is as old as time. Cain and Abel, Romulus and Remus, all families squabble, don't they? But when it plays out in public, things can be difficult. Rock legend Jimmy Barnes's older brother admits he spent some years living in the shadow of his sibling. But John Swan has managed to top the charts with his own material over the years and has had great success with songs released under the moniker Swanny. Temporary Heartache. Lady, what's your name?
I tried to speak, but words cannot explain. I'm much afraid. I write it in a letter, but then what could I say? Guess I'm gonna have to ask you, lady, what's your name? And can I walk beside?
And Swanny's never let any perceived rivalry get to him. He's the eldest of the Swan family, with siblings Jimmy and Alan and Linda and Dorothy and Lisa. John recently gathered his younger brothers Jimmy and Alan together to record a song, Brother of Mine. It's the centrepiece of his latest album, Believe. And what made the moment truly historic was that for the first time ever, all three brothers, Swanny, Jimmy Barnes and Alan Barnes, finally recorded a song together. Well, John Swan, Swanny, joins us for Nightlife tonight. John, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you, sir.
It's
thank you.
Great to have you with us. I mean, lots of us have read the books of younger brother Jimmy Barnes, working class boy and working class man, and seen the docos.
Working class infant, working class geriatric.
It hasn't all been smooth sailing growing up, has it?
He's never worked a day in his life.
No, I'm only kidding. He's the hardest working person in rock and roll.
But it hasn't been smooth sailing, has it? Moving from Glasgow to Adelaide as a kid, I mean, yeah. It was tough. Mum and Dad fought hammer and tongs. It's been written. What was that like for you and in your memory?
I was only 10 when we moved from Scotland. So by the time we got established in Australia, I was probably 12. You know, we got to school straight away, but we went to a hostel, which is where most people do go, most immigrants go, you know. I think they called us £10 tourist. And it was, at the time, it felt such shame. Try going 24,000 kilometres for £10 these days. It was great because we were mixed with a lot of kids who were Greeks and Italians and, you know, Irish, English, Scousers, Geordies, and it was good fun because they all had a similar type outlook on life. They come from a similar type, you know, it's working class background. It's not a salubrious sort of mansion. It's just tenements but for me, that's the way it is. It always was like that. And for 90% of, I would say 80% of Glaswegians, it was the same. I don't think we were special about it. You know, that's where Jim and I have little tiny, not altercations, but we have a verbal disagreement to disagree. You know, I respect his opinion to say what he wants, and, you know, he respects mine. For me, I only remember the love. I remember the good times. I remember playing soccer, boxing, and, you know, I remember my mum and dad fighting and drinking, and that, but that was normal. Yeah. In Glasgow, it's, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen anything from Glasgow, but if you see a cat with a tail, it's a tourist, you know, it's a rough joint.
Yeah, it is. I've been there. I've read memoirs from Glaswegians. It was tough. It's funny that the position in the family, isn't it, John, because, you know, I know in my own family, and plenty of listeners would feel the same, where you were in the family does affect your memory of what happened. You do remember things differently, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I remember specifically where Jim's got a consensus of opinions that he's collected over a period of years. And in my opinion, he's entitled to that. That's his perception. But it's not actually a perception when you're too young to be able to understand it, you know. You don't understand that depth of how people can fall out, you know, not fall out of love. But my mum had me when she was 16. She had six kids by the time she was 22 or something, you know. And so she had no adolescence of her own. She had no understanding of it. And she was bringing us up the way her mother brought her up, exactly like that. It was tough, you know. Mm. But my mum was working. She had two of us alongside of her when she was working in the wash house, they call it. It's a place where they wash the sheets and towels for hospitals. Mm. And they've got these big sort of hand things that you dip in and ringers, you know.
Big coppers and mangles.
Yeah,
and
coppers and steam. And I remember all of that. Yeah. Whereas, see, they to me, to somebody else, they may have been, oh, Christ, poor me, you know, I had to go and go to work with my mum at, you know, 5:30 in the morning and then come home. And, you know, my dad was working two jobs. He was working as a steel fixer at Woodside. Mm. And, you know, my mum worked there as well. She worked part-time there. So they did the best they could with what they had. And honestly, if you had six kids at 22, you'd be absolutely, you know, you'd be out of your mind, because the mere factor that the children, you know, their attention needed and everything else that they need, you know, school needs this, school needs that, school needs that. Well, in Glasgow, school was one of the last things that we actually considered. It was actually what was going on the table and, you know, and trying to put as much love on that table as we could.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, my perception is more from, I could see who's trying and who's not, and that was a great thing. A lot of the time I was farmed out because, being the eldest one, my mum's sister lived, you know, directly across the tenement from us, so she was there, and they were better off. So the eldest son would naturally go to my Auntie Ma's and my Uncle Jackie's. Mm-hmm. And they were wonderful people, you know. Like, I had a great time. You get up in the morning at 5 o'clock when Uncle Jackie comes in, and he had been to the baker's, and, you know, you could smell the fresh rolls and jam and butter and a nice big mug of tea. I didn't get that at home, but I certainly got it at my Auntie Ma's. So I wasn't complaining. And I also had enough nous and was told directly, you're not, it's not that we don't love you, John, it's just that, you know, that the other kids are, they're so close together, it takes such a lot. And they were all basically living in one bedroom. It was called a bed sitter, you know, like where the bed's in the wall, and the kids all slept in there. My mum and dad slept in there. So any chance I got, I would take that opportunity to go. And I was never sent or sort of ostracized and sent away. But I knew that that was the right thing to do. Mm. And I think I've got more of an understanding about what it's like to be, and I say this with great respect, please don't think that I'm caning my brother. I'm not. But he's been very, very well off since 28, you know, when Chisel sort of kicked on and Don Walker came in and they had the hits and all of that sort of stuff. You know, it was enormous money. And he married Jane Barnes, who's a wonderful girl. She's a, you know, they're friends with the King of Thailand and stuff like that. And her parents were loaded too. So it's hard for them to look at our past through their eyes when, you know, they have servants and my parents were servants.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, please don't, as I said, I can't reiterate enough that I'm not bagging Jim or anything like that. It just sometimes hurts me because I think they've been dead for a long time now, you know, like, and it just keeps coming up every now and then. And I get, the next day I don't sort of particularly watch a lot of it. I follow Jim on Facebook, naturally, you know, and we talk more in person. And when we talk in person, it's not about anything like that, you know. It's basically big brother and little brother having a yarn. You know?
Yeah.
And that's great. See, for me, he's not Jimmy Barnes. He's Jimmy.
He's your brother.
He's just Jimmy. You know?
He's a little brother.
If he gets out of line, I'll smack his ass.
You know? I'm talking to John Swanee. He's the older brother of Jimmy Barnes.
Yeah, it's funny because when we did something the other day, and it was like a David Campbell Zumbi, and we put it to air later on, and the girl was saying, the Barnes family this, the Barnes family, you know. And she said, and here's the eldest of the Barnes family, John Swan. And I went, isn't there something that you're missing something there? It's John Swan. And it was Jim Swan and it was Alan Swan until my mum and dad broke, when they finally broke up, she remarried a guy called Reg Barnes. They adopted the kids. And I went with my dad because I was the eldest son. Mm. And that's what the eldest son does in Scotland. You maintain your father's name. You continue it as best you can.
Yeah.
You know, for whether it be a good name or a bad name, that's just the way it is. You know?
John, you were offered a gig in your teens with Cold Chisel before Jimmy. What made you What made you knock it back?
I was playing with Don Walker. We play blues, Chicago blues and stuff like that. And Cold Chisel wasn't like you imagine it now. It was when they got together, it was basically, I know it sounds ridiculous, but it was a covers band. And the only reason it was a covers band because Don was busy doing his quadrant mechanics master's degree, you know. So he didn't have time to write the tunes, didn't have time to get to the rehearsals, didn't play in the band for the first couple of years. And, you know, they just honed their skills. Yeah. So I couldn't take it because I was playing drums at the time and I was making, for me, good money. It was like $25 a week or something, you know. It was money, and rather than start off again with another band that has got to learn, and it's just rehearsal. For the first 20 years, I don't think I earned any money. I never owned a drum kit. Mm-hmm. I never owned a guitar. I never owned anything like that. It was always, I was at the mercy of, not the mercy of, but I was graciously lent instruments because my friends had my back, you know. Their parents were a little bit better off, so he'd get a drum kit. And he said, do you want to borrow it? And I go, yeah. And I said, well, I don't know when I'll be able to get it back because I had to take it in my sister's pram to get it from one suburb to another suburb.
You leave home at 14 to play in a band and you give credit to a couple of musicians for keeping you safe on the streets as a teenager, like Billy Thorpe. We played his It's Almost Summer not so long ago. Colleen Hewitt and Russell Morris.
Russell Morris.
Household names to everyone now. How did they?
Max Merritt. Renee Geyer, you know, Russell to this day is still one of the dearest men in the world. You know, like he was one of the first people I got on the album. And how that came about was I was sitting there thinking about, I'm nearly 74 now, so you get to the point where you start thinking about your own mortality, you know, things go wrong, you have a few issues you've got to fix up. We all do it, you know. It's the guarantee of life. There is birth and there's death, you know, and everything in between it is just good fortune. So I was lying there thinking, I've had a pretty good life. I've got my OAM, I've got Senior Citizen of the Year, I was a runner-up in Australian of the Year, you know, I spent a couple of years in the army, I've played with a lot of great musicians over my life, you know, and I've met a lot more and supported them, you know, Bad Company, Free, Tina Turner, Johnny Winter, you know, from all different genres too, which was lovely because it gave me an opportunity to see what it was like in the big world out there and see how they had to work to make it work. Yeah. The very first person that we supported was with Jim and I joined Stars for the Night, a band called Stars. They were just a good rock band, and they got the Tina Turner, Ike and Tina Turner support. And they said, why don't you come and play it so that you can come out and sing and be on the same stage as Tina Turner? And I said, I'm all for that, you know. So I think I got up and I had a set of timbales and some bongos and stood on the side and hit them, you know, like very gently and did backing vocals. But the main thing for me was I got to walk down the hallway and watched the Ikeettes coming out of the room and I'm going, Jesus, this is great, you know, for a young kid. This is the life. And little did I know that Vanetta Fields was one of the Ikeettes. And Vanetta and I went on to be great friends later on. She was on a lot of my albums of backing vocals with her and Renee. But to get back a little bit further, when I was 14, I went to Melbourne because I had been molested by a family friend, chokehold, family friend. And, you know, it was happening a lot in those days and it was not unique to me. But I decided that the best thing for me to do was, when my mum and dad broke up, was for me to leave and make it a bit easier on
the other kids that were left, my sister took care of everything, you know, like my dad had unfortunately went downhill a bit with the drink, you know, as you do, he's brokenhearted, you know. The band came in on a Sunday night and they said, we're going to Melbourne, do you want to come? And I said, yeah, give me a minute to pack. So I went and got my spare pair of jocks, my spare T-shirt, and packed them in a very small bag. But, you know, it was not sort of, you know, like I'll get ready for the tour. Mm. It was just pack it. I pack a bit like that now still. You know? I take basically what I need, and it's usually a black T-shirt, a couple of pair of jocks. Depending on how I'm feeling, it will be a razor blade and toothpaste. You know, like.
you had success on the charts in your own right with Lady, What's Your Name. It got to number 13. It was one of the biggest selling singles in Australia in 1982. Was there a little rivalry there with the emerging Cold Chisel success?
No. They had already established themselves. See, I got signed the same day. Cold Chisel was getting signed. Mm. And we were at the lunch for the signing, which is usually, you know, record company lunches in those days were notorious long, you know. it was more like breakfast, you know. Like. So as the day progressed, I got on piano and started playing, because I played guitar and drums and piano and bass and that, you know, at this stage. And no disrespect, but Jim didn't play any of them. And I did my best to teach him how to do what he needed to do. And the thing with Jim is he listened to everything you said and went screaming past me about 100 miles an hour because, you know, it's easy for one to tell somebody else what to do, but whether that person is following their own advice, you know, I've got a lot of friends who are like that. They give great advice, but they don't take it, you know. but, you know, I had already been working at 14, I was with a band that had a number one single, Lynn Randell, Chow Baby, Let's Call It a Day, you know, which was produced by Molly in the old days. And she was wonderful, you know. I think I was 13 when I was with them. Mm. And I had people, like you said, Billy Thorpe, I had the guys from the Twilights, I had Russell, I had all of these people who put their arm around me and watched me because I was a young kid and they knew I'd been molested. And you're not sleeping. You're sleeping in the back of a truck. I was sleeping in an orange box. And I slept in the orange box because the rest of the truck was quite cold. In the orange box, they had a tarp over the top of it. Plus, you wouldn't smell as bad the next day. You might have the runs for a month, but, you know.
Tell me about the tragedy about 30 years ago when the truck carrying the band's equipment crashed on its way to a gig and it killed two men. And one of the victims was Alan Dallow. That was your sister Linda's partner. And both men had newborn children. How did that play out as you were just hitting the heights of the music charts?
We were playing up from Melbourne. We had gone down to Melbourne to do Countdown. And what you did to get there was you played a town, every town on the way down. Mm. You know, if you could get any more than 20 or 30K, you could play at a hotel. That would get you enough to get the truck to the next town, and dinner on a table and a drink at night. And, you know, hopefully you get a drink at night. And that was the main thing at that stage was just to be surviving. But I had the truck and I had a massive big PA system. It was Dragon's PA. It was actually Sebastian Chase owned it. And the truck was going down the hill. We were in Wagga. Mm. And, you know, the last time I was in Wagga, I was stationed there in Kapuka. But this time we were there and the gig got cancelled. And we went out on the Terps and did what boys do, you know. We all got out on the Terps and some went off with girls and some didn't. And the rest of us just stood around and fought with each other. And it was like a disagreement at the end of the night. And the next morning they were under the truck fixing something and that's it. So, you know, like, give my wave. And I regret not having said goodbye properly because one never knows what's next, you know.
You never know.
But I got to Wollongong at Thirroul and the manager got to me and said, Johnny said, the police are on the phone for you. I said, tell him I didn't know it was his sister. And, you know, and he said, no, you better come. So I went and he said, John Swell, I said, yes. He said, there's been an accident. And I said, oh, no, what's happened? You know, the last thing you think of is two of you guys have been incinerated. There's not a thing left in the truck. And the other two guys had a broken leg where Alan Della was trying to pull John Affleck
out of the back and out of the chair and get Billy out as well. He knew that he was strapped, but he was trying his best to get the other guys out, you know. And to me, that's I live that stuff much more with pain than I did my childhood. My childhood was a breeze compared to that because new babies in the world.
I
had to go and tell my sister. And we did the gig that night, by the way. We got there and the promoter said, I'll hire another band and you can use their gear. So we went on and played, and it was probably one of the best gigs I've ever done, you know, because everybody in the audience knew it, that what had gone on, because, you know, that sort of stuff travels so fast.
How did you recover? What do you credit as the reason for your recovery?
I don't think I did. I think I went downhill more. I had a substance abuse, and, you know, I was sponsored by a brewery, so that's a great idea. Give an alcoholic a sponsorship for a brewery, you know. There's a wise move, boys. You know, but you know what? That was the way I handled it, and it wasn't just that. It was a whole bunch of other things that you accumulate as life goes on, and they're just life's dramas. The boys being killed was something I still live with today, because I was in Penrith doing that big Empire Strikes Back to, and there's 15 bands and 10,000 people there. And I'm looking in the audience, and there's Alan Deller's granddaughter standing there. And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and she smiled, and I could just see Alan, you know. And that put me, I was doing Lady, What's Your Name. So I just held the mic out the front, and the audience started singing, and I had to take a second to gather myself, because you can't get that type of emotion on stage, because once it comes, it's a flood. It's not just a little wash of emotion. It's a flood. Because all the guilt and all the stuff that you blame yourself for, and it's not my fault that the tire blew out, and it's not my fault that the two guys, they hit a tree that was the biggest one. There's only three trees here, two small ones and one big one, and they hit the big one. And it literally... The truck just blew up on the spot, and when the police told me what he said, there was nothing there. They gave me a bag with the Alan's watch and stuff like that, and then I had a skin in the watch, and you know, and they're things that, you know, I think first, you know, people who attend accidents first will realize that smell. You never get rid of it, and when I see the children, I see their dads. You know, and all the life that I've had and all the things that I've done, they never got to do. So I take what I do very seriously, and I make sure that I'm grateful for everything that I get, you know.
Yeah, I know those who know, of course, know you are aware of all your humanitarian work. John, singing for palliative care patients and kids in the burns wards and so on. As you've just said, you've had that, you've seen this, you know the perspective, you're not just doing good. You're living it.
It's not even. It wasn't about doing good. What I suddenly realized was that I'll be really honest with you. I get stage fright, right? And I've got stage fright since day one. And I was playing with Lynn Randell and a child baby, and I'm sitting there playing drums, and all of a sudden I got this wash of fear go through me, like a panic attack, you know. So I got up and I run off the stage, and this big burly sort of bikey guy stopped. He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Can't you get off? She's doing her hit. Get it back on her." I said, I can't do it. And he said, "Here." He said, "You're having an anxiety attack," and he gave me a nip of scotch, and I sculled it. And, you know, I'm 13. It hit the sweet spot. And I walked back on that stage like I was, you know, Muhammad Ali stage, you know, just walking on there, it was mine. And from then on, it became the go-to thing to do.
So
I guess that with the drinking and the abuse, that was trying to cover up stuff that I hadn't dealt with. And, you know, when I seen the other kids' faces in those hospitals, a lot of them were brain-damaged kids, who they wear little caps, little skull caps, because they take the top of the brain off to release the pressure. And I went out there every day. It started off just a girl rung me up and she said, "My husband's in hospice, he's dying. Can you go and see him? He's a huge fan of yours." And I said, "Sure, of course I can." And she said, "If you feel like it, take your guitar." So I took my guitar and I went out, and met this guy. He's 40-year-old, good-looking young guy. He's just met this girl. They've got three kids each, and they're all under 10. And he's a pilot, and he gets cancer. I mean, that's a stroke of bad luck. So I sat down and I said, can I play a song for you? He said, oh, yeah, that'd be great. What do you want to hear? I think it was Better Be Home Soon or something like that. And I played it, and the nurse came in and she said, oh, the guy in the next ward wants to know if you can come down and play a song. I was there till 10 o'clock at night, just going up and down the thing. And these are guys who are on the drip to slow down their respiratory system so that they can die easy. Or easier, if there's such a thing as die easy. I suddenly realized that I have something of value that other people need in their times of need.
You know, you do, John. You do.
It's not about trying to be a good guy or anything like that. No. It's just people are less fortunate than me. I'm there.
You know? You've walked the road, John. You have walked the road. The song we're going to spin out of Night Love is Brother of Mine. Now, this track, you've reached out to the clan, younger siblings, Jimmy. Yep. And Quiet Achiever Alan. Tell us about the vibe in the studio recording this one.
I just, what I did was I was lying in bed watching the Matildas playing soccer. And I was thinking about, you know, my mortality, what have I got to do, what's on my bucket list, that sort of thing. You know, all the things that morbid people are out and awake thinking at night. And I just got up my phone and I put a text out to Jim and Alan. I thought, I've got to record with my two brothers, both brothers, before I release this Mortal Coil, you know. And so I sent them a text saying, I'm going to do a duets album. Would you care to do one with me? Mm. And I expected, you know, Jim's that busy, expecting a message in a week later, 2 weeks later. But it was just straight away, bang, yes, let's do it. About effing time, you know. And I lay there for a couple of minutes. And then that part of me, which is always the survivor and trying to get ahead, said, well, why don't we get some more friends in there? So I put Russell, they just added them to the names in the text. It was the same text, went to everybody. That was John Stevens, Russell, everybody, Joe Camilleri, Wendy Matthews, a whole bunch of people, you know, like Ian Moss, what a gentleman, you know. And, you know, the wonderful, wonderful Jack Jones, you know, like he's just superb. And these guys, that album is more a testament to friendship than it is about getting into a really expensive studio and trying to make it look sound good and do everything like that. It was, yes, what do you need? Not how much am I getting for it and what do I have to do to get it? Done.
Good on you. Good on you. Great. It's great talking to you, John. Terrific.
Oh, absolutely.
What a life.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.